Glad we can be here together and enjoy this time and this fellowship. Just out of curiosity, before I give the title, does anybody bring a pillow? Anybody bring a pillow? No pillows? Okay, then I can be pretty much assured I won't be tarred and feathered before I get done here. The subject that I want to spend some time on is where only fools dare to tread. And I may well be there at that situation. It says it's on. Okay. And so I'd like to spend some time looking at what the Bible has to say with respect to what kind of government should we have. And so I'd like to have you turn with me to the book of Genesis. Genesis chapter 6, verse 5. And while we're doing that, I suppose maybe I should go backwards just a little bit and rewind to the time. Because we need to publicize our Calvary Quartet that's going to be singing this next Sunday, next Saturday and Sunday. And just to remind you that this is should be a very special time for us as these folks come in. And I don't know if all of the lists are filled up with names for all the supplies or not. But if not, why, check it out. And you haven't had a chance to be a part of it, please check it out and join in. So next Saturday at 6 p.m. is the first starting event for the Calvary Quartet, and we hope that this will be a special time for you. As I looked into this area of government, in Genesis chapter 6, verses 5, 6, and 7, I'd like to read those verses, if I may. It says, "And God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And it repented the Lord that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him at his heart. And the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast and creeping thing, and the fowls of the air, for it repenteth me that I have made them." And then the manner of the graciousness of God is in verse 8, "But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord." And if you have read the rest of the story, you know that this is a marvelous thing. One of the reasons I would see as we look in the Scriptures for government is that there's wickedness. There's wickedness. And with the concept of wickedness, there are people who are not doing right, they're not doing good, they're not being just, they're not being, the principle of love is just totally out when wickedness is in operation. And wickedness, under the principles of God, requires judgment. So then we go to chapter 9 of Genesis, chapter 9, and we have a couple of verses there. In the process of all this time in between chapter 6 and chapter 9, we find that, as I mentioned judgment, we find that judgment really does take place. God deals with that which is wrong, with that which is of great, great violation of anything that's right. God deals with it. And then we come to chapter 9 and the process of coming into there, and we find that after the flood, God then starts everything over again as far as man is concerned. He's taken Noah and his sons and their wives and brought them through the flood, and he is providing that there would be a clean start in all of this. And yet with reality, we go to chapter 9 and verse 5, and we find that it says, "And surely your blood of your lives will I require, at the hand of every beast will I require it, and at the hand of man, at the hand of every man's brother will I require the life of man. Whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God made he man. And you be fruitful and multiply and bring forth abundantly in the earth and multiply therein. Now, why would this command be here? Except that we had the situation and the instance of murder taking place before the flood. And you think about this now. Even though we've gone and taken these several families and carried them through the flood and established them now into this new earth arrangement that has been established, everything is fresh. But in the process of all this, what we're finding is that man has already learned an awful lot of wickedness. Noah and his family. And they have long memories. Now, we're talking about memories that are longer than yours because, at least as far as Noah is concerned, he lived an awful long time. A lot longer than anybody here. And his sons weren't young either when all of this was taking place. They were full adults. They were married. They had been involved in a good deal of the building of the ark, it appears, and the process of all of this flood that had taken place. They had a long time to learn a lot of wickedness, at least to have it observed and embedded in their hearts and in their minds. Now, this is something that we have to think about in terms of our own personal lives, is that the longer we live, the longer we have to learn that which is contrary to right and good and that which is just. The longer we live, the longer we have to try out some of these things that we learn. The longer we have, the longer we have opportunity to pervert away from that which is God's pure will and provision for us. And so here we have this warning, we should say this arrangement which God had given to Noah and his sons, that they had better be careful. Life was extremely cheap in those days. Not too much different than today, is it? Life is pretty cheap today, too, it seems. It just doesn't take too much for someone to shoot up a crowd. It doesn't take too much for someone to lay in wait. It doesn't take too much, like the pastor was saying this morning, even with abortions. Life is cheap. Life is cheap. It's just cheap in our world, in our day. It doesn't take much for someone to say, I just think someone's in my way. I'll just eliminate them. And that's the way it is. So God was not intending that this should be considered particularly in a light manner, that you would go and take the blood of someone else and destroy them. So this is why he says in verse 6, whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God made he man. This is often considered the first instance of what we would call government, as we read this in the Scriptures. And so government, or the rule over man, is often a concept which is corrupted, even though it is in a principle, by principle of God, to keep corruption at bay. The first example of corruption shows up not too long after the flood. We can turn to chapter 10, and we can see that this shows up in the situation of chapter 10, verse 8, where we have a man who is born of Cush, and his name was Nimrod. Nimrod. Cush begat Nimrod, and he began to be a mighty one in the earth. Now, think about this for a minute. When we're talking about Nimrod and we're talking about the one who is a mighty one here in the earth, we have to keep in mind that this wasn't really the intention of God. We don't see anywhere in the Scriptures, especially in the early chapters of Genesis, even as I would read, even all the way through, particularly in all of the book of Genesis, we don't see where God would, what we would call, establish a formal government such as what Nimrod was inclined to do. Nimrod was a fellow who, as it tells us here, he began to be a mighty one in the earth. Now, when we're talking about a mighty one in the earth, we're talking about someone who is reverenced or respected or considered as a leader. By what reason or cause? Well, he was a great hunter. He seemed to be potentially one who was able to go out and bring in any manner of game and such as this. But when it talks about a mighty one in the earth, we have to consider that this man Nimrod was assuming what you could call the rule over people. And so here we find that Nimrod formed a city. He's noted for building a city, the city called Babel. And also, I was curious to note that there were several others that were nearby that he seemed to be responsible for, too. And so this mighty one, he was powerful. The concept mighty one suggests that he was a warrior. It even allows, the meaning allows the concept of a tyrant or a valiant man. He's one who would potentially be thought of as a strong man. And by implication, it suggests that he prevailed over other people and acted in an insolent manner, even on occasions. This is how the definition of the dictionaries suggest this mighty one could be considered. Now, when we're looking at the idea of insolence, it's someone who's proud and haughty, with contempt for others or of others. He's overbearing, dominating in power, and he's a master over them. Now, I don't know if you had a chance to read today's paper or not, but it suggests, some of these descriptions that are there suggest Omar Gaddafi. Some of these other rulers who are around the world. By the way, you don't have to go to the Arab world. You can go to Russia and pick up the names of a lot of people. You can go to Europe and start listing out the kings and some of the leaders there. You can go to Rome, days gone by. And you could probably point out a few people in our country who would have a certain degree of insolence and want to have power and control and rule over someone else. I wouldn't be surprised. It wouldn't be too hard to go come into our county and name a few people here in the days gone by. So here we have this man who assumed, and this is where I'm putting it, he's assumed for himself that he has control over others, whether it's by intimidation or by respect or by whatever means. He assumed control over a wide area of people. Now, let me ask you this question. We could look at our own country and go back into the, oh, say, 1805 to 1900. And I don't know about you. Maybe you folks don't think of the Oregon Trail and all the settlement of the West. But you ought to go back maybe and think about the settlement of Katanning and Butler and Freeport and some of these other places like Pittsburgh when they first were starting to settle out with people. For the most part, these folks moved into an area, cleared out some land, and they put in a farm. And maybe they had a little interaction with their neighbors. But for the most part, even this part of the country here, when we started opening up this land, we weren't really thinking of anyone being mayor of Katanning in those early days. We weren't thinking of anyone being involved in, they may have had a little bit of a militia to protect from the Indians, but other than that, once that kind of settled down, everybody did their own thing on their own land, and there wasn't anybody who probably was especially considered a strong man. Now, I don't know the history here well enough to be able to say that's not true, but for the most part, my hunch is that you came into this area, forefathers came into this area, and they said, this is my little bailiwick, me, my wife, and my 5 or 10 kids, and we cleared some land, we grew some crops, and we fed our cattle, and sheared our sheep, and whatever we did, and we didn't really bother about a whole lot going on. We didn't really have too much concern about what you would call strong men, or that which would be in charge and kind of controlling us, until certain people came in and found out that there's coal, and they found out that there's iron ore, and they put up some foundries and things like this, and then we drew a lot of people in from Europe and settled here and Brady's Bend and other places up through here, and then we started having villages, and we started having people rob each other and start carrying on. That's probably about the time when the sheriffs and all of these other people really started getting a little bit of ascendancy, and then we decided we needed somebody to rule over us to kind of stop these kinds of things and the murder that I'm sure it was going on in those days. But for the most part, our country, for a long period of time in different regions according to their time, our country was essentially without government of any real means. Oh, you had a few people that said, let's turn Ohio into a state, let's turn Michigan into a state, let's turn Iowa into a state. How about Colorado and Montana? And then they had Washington, and then they divided Idaho off, and you see that they kind of gerrymandered that out of everybody else. But for the most part, all of those people, they were their own people, even in their small villages. They really didn't have a whole lot of organization. And they lived, for the most part, in most places, on a rather peaceable, genteel manner, as would be available in that particular location. Now, what was the provision of order that was there? See, that's the curious question. What is it that made our country so peculiarly different than all of the rest of the world that was going on at that time, that made us a people who were a strong people in many ways, have great capability, but we were just kind of quietly operating and doing our own thing in our own place as we went on around our situation? I would suggest that it goes back to the very earliest part of Genesis, where God, even as He told Noah and his family, basically they were to go and to replenish the earth and to go and do their thing, but love the Lord and obey His commandments and do that which is right and go and fill the earth. That's really the principle that was behind of what all they did. So, as we look at this, there's a couple, three principles I'd like to suggest that would be involved in here. One is, they knew what their job was, and they were accountable to do it. Now, I don't know about the Gillum clan as they came into this area and opened up the farm that was up there on the hill there a little ways away from here. But my hunch is that they knew what their job was to do, and they showed a degree of accountability. They opened up the farm, they planted the seed, they hoed the ground, they harvested their crops and stowed stuff away for the winter and replanted in the spring, and they did it over and over and over again. And they minded their business, I presume. I haven't heard anything otherwise. And so they kept their duties in that Now, if they didn't do that, think about the consequences. You see, there is consequences when accountability doesn't take place. If you didn't plant your seed and do due diligence to make sure that those crops came up, that next winter was rather thin and you were rather hungry. And if it was by reason of slovenliness, I mean, you didn't do any work as you ought to have done, then that winter you lost a lot of weight. And the neighbors weren't particularly inclined to come over and show kindness to you if you're lazy and aren't willing to do that which ought to be done. And so then you learn from that. They might have made sure you got through to the next planting season and had a chance to get started again. But if you fail two or three winters in a row, two or three harvest and planting and harvest seasons in a row, my hunch is that they probably would have just pretty much said, you need to go somewhere else because you're not doing what you ought to be doing here and we're not going to carry you. Now, accountability and lack of accountability also has its subsequent consequences. And we need to carry through with and allow the consequences to be there. God does. Now, if I don't show willingness to do anything and just ride off the land and let everybody else do all the work and pass it to me, then the probability is that I don't see too many situations where God would be just inclined to just reach down with his hand and fill my larder full of all kinds of provisions if I'm just not going to do anything. Sit and watch TV Something I've heard in other places, Dancing with the Stars. Everybody wants to seem to watch that. And so there they are. They're doing that. And it's a little cold. Sun came out, but I don't care. I'll wait. And so spring comes and there's no turning of the ground. Spring goes and there's no planting of the seed. Summer's here and there's still no effort. And so then when fall comes, there's no harvest. And when there's no harvest, there's no food in the pantry. And when there's no food in the pantry, the winter gets a little bit tough. Consequences. When we do things wrong, there should be consequences. Within the family, we find that God established Adam and Eve. And then we had Cain and Abel and Seth, and then there were other sons and daughters. Apparently, these folks had a responsibility to go and to do that which was right and to fulfill their responsibilities, and they went, and to a large degree, most of them did, although we had a little murder intrigue in the place there as it went along, and that seemed to grow as the years went along. After 2,000 years, it seemed to be largely rampant, and things were terrible then. By the way, consequences came, and we had a flood. It was right. It was right. But family is the original origin of social order that is here. Now, we see a lot of things going on in our world today. We see where young people are growing up. They seem to have no regard for marriage. They seem to have no regard for family. They seem to have little or any regard for parents on many occasions. They go along and it appears that they're succeeding and carrying along, and all of a sudden things start falling out from under them. God is allowing natural consequences to begin to take place. They have some choices. They can either go on the dole in a situation whereby no one holds them accountable. But if that dole wasn't there, what other place would they have to go? Mama, Dad, help me, I'm in trouble. I'm getting hungry. Mom and Dad says, oh, I wonder why. I've given you this advice. I've given you this training. I've done this and that for you. And now you say, you want some help. Well, now here's where the social order begins to take place. You come back into my home and you're going to be responsible. You're going to be accountable. You're going to be dependent. Nobody wants to be dependent. Think about that now. When's the last time you said, I'd like to be dependent rather than independent? When's the last time you said, I'd rather be dependent? Submitting to proper authority. Now, if you're hungry enough, the probability is that you're going to go back to mom and you're going to go back to dad, and the accountability is going to take place because they're going to require it. Because if you don't want to be accountable, you still want to be independent and still want to be irresponsibility. Show irresponsibility in your life. Be irresponsible. That's the word I'm looking for. You still want to be irresponsible. Don't come here and don't sit at my table. And don't expect mom to be helping out with the clothes washing. And don't be expecting that you're going to partake in the fruit of the garden, because those who are responsible are going to be partaking of the fruit of the garden. Now, think about this for a minute. We're talking about government. When we look at government, we don't see anything where government outside of the family is instituted. And for the most part, it's not even instituted in the day of Moses, or in the day of Noah coming out of the flood, except where people fail utterly. They go and murder someone else. And the accountability is that the immediate community then takes responsibility and they take their life and end that, so that accountability ultimately is applied in this situation. Now, we're talking about government. You think about this now. We have, by government, what is it? One-third or two-thirds of the budget now goes to what we call welfare. Think about this now. If we didn't have the option of going to the government for welfare, especially those who are making no effort to be responsible or accountable, where would they have to turn? They would have to turn to either an individual that they could con into helping them, however long that may happen, or they're going to have to go home. Now, I'm not saying that all provisions are wrong, because some provisions are right, but most of the provisions that are going out today, I think I could say this to a large extent, most of the provisions that go out today are going to people who are irresponsible. And for the most part, we should be able to, if we were to bring all of this down from the federal level, take it out of their hands, bring it out of the state level, take it out of their hands, bring it down to the local level where I know you and you know me. And I know whether you're being responsible, accountable, and such. Or I know if you really have a need and you can't do things yourself, then I, on the local level, can work with you and help take care of you in the ways that are necessary. But how can someone in Harrisburg ever have any real knowledge, or out of the federal level, have any real knowledge as to a lot of these things that are there? Now, we can say, well, they have offices and this kind of stuff, but most of the entitlement programs are based upon very few requirements. And those requirements, as long as you can meet them in some technical way, they can't turn you down. But I would suggest that your neighbors and those who are living in the village in which you live have a chance to watch you a little bit. You come in as a stranger, they're going to make sure you prove yourself. as being accountable, responsible, and such things, and dependent and submission to proper authority. They're going to make sure those things happen. We don't have much of this stuff going on. If you go across the neighborhoods and you show this one here who chooses to raise children outside of marriage, and you have this one here who chooses to live in a manner which by which they have never made an effort, and you go in these things and you begin to realize what I'm trying to say here is this, is that the Bible starts out with government being taking place in a local situation and continuing on in that manner. Now, we find that cities, for the most part, cities are something that is, and we were looking here earlier at Nimrod building a city called Babel and some others. We find that a city, I don't see anywhere in the scriptures, in the book of Genesis, where a city is even suggested. A city was first started by Cain before the flood. And then after the flood, we still don't see any mention of cities until Nimrod. And he is one who is a reprobate, one who hates the will of God. Instead of saying we will disperse across the world and populate and fill the land, as God said, we're going to all be in one place and make a name for ourselves. Cities still, after the flood, as it started out, were not that which was what we would call an approved activity by God. Now, we also know that when we get into the book of Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, then they talk about cities, as I would see it, for the first time in what you would call an approved manner. But even those cities are not the same kind of cities that we would see in the rest of the world. We would see in those cities, we would see a situation whereby they were cities of refuge. They were populated by a particular kind of people of the population. They were the Levites. And they were not to have land for a purpose because their job was to take care of the tabernacle and to work there. But they were in cities and they were given garden space around the outside the perimeter of the cities whereby they could do some of the minor, what you'd call minor agriculture, kitchen garden type stuff. But those were the places where if I went, and Pastor was talking about this earlier, in Numbers we have the cities of refuge, chapter 35, verses 11 through 34, where the cities of refuge were there. The reason for the cities of refuge was to deal with the specific concern of murder. Okay? Now, here I am. I'm working out with you in your land, and I pick up an axe and chopping at a tree and swing it back, and the head comes off and hits you in the head, and you are demised. Now, here's the question. Was it murder or was it not murder? If it was murder, the specific rule that goes all the way back to Noah is that because I took your life, your blood was shed, mine shall pay for it. But if it wasn't intended, it just was what you'd call a circumstance of situation where I didn't hate you. You're my friend. I was out there helping you. And still it happened. I was to run to the city of refuge, and there the elders of the city would determine whether or not what I did was with intent or as a perchance situation that you died because of whatever reason that I didn't intend to kill you. Now, that's the only situation whereby a city is involved, especially in terms of order that is to take place throughout the country. So you're this guy's family that I just whacked with an axe and he's gone. You come to the city of refuge and you say, this man killed my husband, my brother, my nephew. And I want you to turn him over to me because his blood should pay for the blood of the one who died. The elders of the city, and this is the highest level of authority that Israel had in this area, the elders of the city drew me before them and you before them, and they heard the case. And if they determined that it was not by premeditation or because I hated the fellow ahead of time, then they would allow me to stay in that city until the death of the priest, high priest, which could be for a long time. And if I wandered outside of the environs of the city, which would mean not only the walls, but also the gardens that were outside the walls, if I wandered outside the environs of the city and you caught me, my blood could be taken and there would be no guilt. That essentially is the highest level of what we would call judicial court situations in all of Israel for a long, long time, until such time as Israel called for a king. That was the intended order by which government was to take place in Israel. Now, there were other situations whereby the judges or the elders of the city might be determining something and they could not come to a decision. It was beyond their scope of grasping, perhaps what we'd call the law. Then there, this would be just the general village or anywhere that's around about, or the gathering of farmers at the nearby village. Then they might perhaps call upon the appointed judge of the day. So we had different judges through different periods of time, and the book of Judges would be involved there. There would be a situation whereby there might be one who would be appointed if things just could not be decided on the local level. And then the determination would be made, but the local village would settle out the orders of the judge, for the most part, the local people. Now, as we look at all of this, we have to think, what is the purpose of government? What is it that is the purpose of government? How much should we be extending way up the ladder, and how much should we be requiring to be done at the local level? Now, folks, when's the last time you read the Constitution of the United States? Some of you, it might be a long time. Some of you may have never read it. But are you understanding, or could it be that you would understand, that the Constitution of the United States of America was intended that there would be a federal government with very limited powers? Very limited powers. That all of the rest of the powers that are not enumerated, that means they're listed 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in the Constitution, then reside with the states like Pennsylvania, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, state of New York. Or even more than that, even they are not allowed to have great power. They also have enumerated powers, 1, 2, 3. And if you read the Constitution of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, you'll find that their powers are indeed enumerated. All of the rest of the powers reside with you, the people. There is a prince, can't say Liechtenstein, that the chief head ruler of Liechtenstein, he said, the thing that makes this country unique over most of the European countries is that the federal powers, or whatever you would call it, the state, the highest powers of Liechtenstein held by me, the prince, and the royal family are very, very limited. We don't assume much of anything, any more than we have to, for the general welfare and relationship of international relations. He said, what makes our country one of the most unique countries and one of the soundest political countries is that we let all of the villages and all of the cities do the ruling that has to be done. Because that's where the people are, and that's where the need is, and they take care of their own problems and their own circumstances. We let all of this stuff reside down at the local level. Now, this is important. I don't doubt that what they read, some of the documents that came from the United States when we formed our Constitution and our documents for the state governments and such, they begin to realize, keep all of this down at the local level. Why? Because God set the example. God set the example. Now, I can say that, and a lot of people are going to laugh at me. And they didn't laugh in the days of the Constitution when it was written. They're laughing now, and since 1901 to 1999 and these subsequent years, because we had a country that at one time said God is supreme. We didn't learn it ourselves. We learned it from England. We learned it from a gentleman by the name of Sir William Blackstone in England. He was a fellow who, some of it was self-educated, some of it was university-educated, some of it, he had some troubles in his earlier life, and he was boo-hooed and told to go home on a number of situations in a sense, and he went back and got into his office and he studied and he started writing out the principles of law. And my hunch is that most of the judges who stand before you and me today have never even read the introduction to Blackstone, let alone figure out how law ought to be done. Let me give you an example. Oh, by the way, when he made this lecture and he was presenting it to his law students in those days, he spent the first 15 minutes apologizing because it was too simplistic. Now listen to me. Law, in its most general and comprehensive sense, signifies a rule of action and is applied indiscriminately to all kinds of action, whether animate or inanimate, rational or irrational. Thus we say the laws of motion, of gravitation, optics, mechanics, as well as the laws of nature and of nations. And it is that rule of action which is prescribed by some superior and which the inferior is bound to obey. A superior made the rules and an inferior has to obey it. Okay? Now, just so you have an understanding of who the superior is, the next paragraph is really plain. It says thus, when the supreme being formed the universe, you heard that before? When the supreme being formed the universe and created matter out of nothing, he impressed certain principles upon that matter from which it can never depart and without which it would cease to be. When he put that matter into motion, he established certain laws of motion to which all movable bodies must conform and to be descent from the greatest operations to the smallest. When a workman forms a clock or other piece of mechanism, he establishes, at his own pleasure, certain arbitrary laws for its direction, as that the hand shall describe a given space in a given time, to which law, as long as the work conforms, so long as it continues in perfection, answers the end of its formation. Basically, it's this. If I make a clock, I establish a law that that hand on the clock is going to make a circle around the clock according to the length of time and the gears and everything that I formed to put into that clock. By the way, the hour hand or the minute hand has no choice in terms of its motion, whether it will or will not move, and how fast it'll move. The superior makes the rules, and the inferior follows the rules. Man, considered as a creature, must necessarily be subject to the laws of his Creator, for he is entirely a dependent being. A being independent of any other has no rule to pursue, but such as he prescribes to himself. But a state of dependence will invariably oblige the inferior to take the will of him on whom he depends as the rule of his conduct. Not indeed in every particular, but in all those points wherein his dependence consists. This principle, therefore, has more or less extent and effect in proportion as the superiority of the one and the dependence of the other is greater or less, absolute or limited, and the consequence is a man depends absolutely upon his Maker for everything. It is necessary that he should in all points conform to his Master's will. I've only read three paragraphs. If you want to understand and look on having fun with theology, 10 pages, and this is one of four introductions. He's basically saying this. Whether or not you choose to obey the superior, you will obey the superior because he provides the order wherein you have no capability to do otherwise, except if you try to choose to do otherwise, there's consequences, and that you cannot escape. Now, run out of time. The thing that I'm trying to put across here is this, is that we have Pat Toomey, who was elected to office. He's in the Congress. I have no idea whether Pat Toomey has ever read this stuff or not. I'm going to send him a copy. But one thing I do know is that you have a responsibility to Pat Toomey. You should have met him this past year. There were opportunities whereby you had no cause to have to pay money. At least the men of the family. You should have met him. You should have shaken his hand, and you should have told him that you believe in the law of God. We also have Tom Corbett, who's governor of the state. There were many opportunities in our county to meet him personally. You should have met him. Don White, senator to the Pennsylvania legislature. Jeff Pyle. These two, Jeff Pyle was recently reelected, and he was all over the county talking to people, making himself available. Don White is also available. If you make an appointment, he will talk to you. We have Rich Fink, Jim Scahill, Patricia Kirkpatrick, all running, or rerunning, I should say, for county commissioners. Whoever wins, and there's what? That's three out of seven or more, or four, six more, or whatever. There's several. All of these people, they're going to be voting for next month. If you don't make every effort to meet as many as you can and tell them that you expect of them proper government according to the authority and the maker whereby we are obliged to obey. You should know what government is and what it ought to be according to scriptures. You need to study it if you don't. We have all kinds of people going into township supervisors around the county and other row officers that are there in the county. We are responsible to know who they are. Just because we may vote for one and the other one gets in doesn't mean that we don't have responsibility to teach these people what right government is. If you don't, and if I don't, who is going to? We have the truth. Who's going to teach them if we don't? That's one of the responsibilities. I think it's Philippians tells us that we are responsible to teach those who are in authority. We don't rule them, we teach them. There's a big difference. One is letting them know what ought to be and helping them to understand it. We also understand that they are over us. And if there's real rule going to take place, we need to understand that they have authorities by which we will have to follow, right or wrong. Although you read Blackstone, and he also says, if they go against the ultimate authority of the Creator, we are obliged to follow the higher order, the higher rule. Do you even know what that is? Practical theology is where I think this falls, and we need to bow in prayer. Heavenly Father, thank you for the time we have here and the privilege we have to enjoy looking in your scriptures. I pray, Father, that we might be able to consult together so that one or the other of us does not go astray from that which is really true. It's part of understanding where the rocks and the gravel and all of that which does the polishing within the tumbler of this church needs to take place. Father, may we do that which is pleasing in your sight. I pray in Jesus' name. Amen.